that, $704.
Obviously, we're never gonna get all this finished, but we'll do it first.
$704, how did it start?
Bless the Lord, oh my soul, oh Yahweh, you are very great. Yahweh is the name of God in the Old Testament. He used it because I happen to like it. You can translate Lord if you want to.
You are clothed with honor and with majesty. You cover yourself with light as with a garment. You stretched out the heavens as a tent. You laid the beams of your chambers in the waters. You made the clouds your chariots. You ride in the wings of the wind. You make the winds your angels. Flame and fire your messengers. Now, what do you discover when you listen to Psalm 104 begin to portray God the Creator? What did you hear as you listened to that? What did you hear? Did anything suddenly ring a bell with you in relationship to the first section we read? Right?
It seems to what you alluded before said that we're looking at writings by the mind or scientific mind of men at that time. Did we know or could we have known that, for example, if they saw lightning, they didn't understand lightning, and they call it the fire from God.
Right.
They didn't understand wind as we do today. They probably call it the Spirit of God.
What does he call wind here?
Angels.
The winds are called angels.
Yeah, okay, angels.
Right.
In other words, the writing here of Psalm and of Genesis is writing of man at that time, how they understood it, just like what they... Today we know there's no difference between night and day in the universe. But they,
right.
They didn't know that the world went around.
Yes, okay.
So
I didn't even think of that. But that's right. In a sense, you know, what's light night that for me is day for my buddies in Australia, you know.
Right.
Yes. Okay. Okay.
But that clears up a question for me, though, just what you said, because it says day, light, day, and the darkness is called night, and then he says one day, and I'm saying, now how can it be one day when he says light is day? And so there is light around the world always.
And there is darkness. Okay.
Yeah, well, that's kind of, you brought to my mind when you, you know, I started to think about the business of those white people today, what it might mean besides like it seems to me, and also when you put it in Christ there, that I just meant God was ushering into the chaotic state opportunity, an opportunity for something constructive to take place.
His very presence, as it were. That he was coming, that he was creating, that he was there, that life was entering the scene. Is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Well, what happens in terms of the light in Psalm 104? What is light in Psalm 104? That which covers God. When God comes, there's light, says Psalm 104. Now, if you were to read Genesis 1 in the light of Psalm 104, and when God says, let there be light, what happens? He comes. That's the way Psalm 104 would say it. You are covered with light. God hides himself in light. That's an interesting description. And you repeatedly have that symbol, that God is, the way you discern God, you discern him in light. And when God says, let there be light, it's another way of saying, could be. Psalm 104 would say, God came onto the scene. That could be. I'm not saying there necessarily is, but listen to how different people portray light. In this case, it's not the same as it is quite in Genesis 1. It portrays it as the covering of God. Also, look at the way it portrays how you create the heavens. You stretch them out like a tent. Now, a firmament functions as that which holds back the water. What is the function of a tent in the ancient world?
About the weather.
All right, for shelter from the weather would be one possibility. What else?
A home.
A home, a place to dwell. And where did Israel, when they went across the wilderness, they were in a tent. And where did God appear? In the tabernacle, which is a form of a tent. Tent of meeting. God lived, dwelt, came, or appeared, made himself manifest in the tent to Moses. Now, when you say tent, then, it's a place where you come, a place where you dwell. It's a way of saying that's God's abode. He stretches out the heavens to be a tent, not to keep back waters this time. And when he's just after he said that, then it also does a parallel to that. What do they say? You build your chambers, apparently some abode of God, where? Well, are these waters here or these? Where is God's abode? Logically, up top, isn't it? We'll put God up there. He's got a chamber in the waters.
Well,
all right, well, you put him down here. Okay, come on. Put him where he's down under. Yeah, okay, right. However, you guys have it all upside down. You down there, we know what's on top. So if you want to be that kind of precise about it, you're going to have an argument, right? Obviously, this is a metaphor of some kind to describe the abode of God. And if you want to describe it in terms of its cosmic greatness, I think you can describe it in terms of being in the waters, which is a very interesting fact. He stretches out a tent, one way of saying he makes a place for himself to appear, or he builds a chamber up in the waters to appear where he dwells. In short, if you look outside, says the Old Testament, and see the sky, that's God's tent. That's where he appears. That's where the light comes. Or, he says, and sometimes he comes on chariots, which are the clouds. Sometimes he rides on the wind, which is his chariot also. Sometimes his winds come as his angels. So throughout that sky, you will find ways in which God comes in his tent called the sky. Whether it's in the angels, or the flame, or the lightning, as you mentioned. Very interesting pictures of how God comes. And why he builds the sky. Not quite the same picture as in Genesis 1, so why the sky was created. All right. Let's turn over to Genesis 2. See what it's like at the beginning of things. Next chapter. On the day that Yahweh God made the heavens and the earth. No, it's earth and heaven this time. Strange. Why'd he switch them? Good question. I don't know the answer yet. But somebody switched them. One of the few places in the whole Old Testament they're switched. Got earth and heaven instead of heaven and earth. And the poem critic asks the question, why were they switched? He may not have the answer, but he asks the question. And when no plant was on the field, and no herb was made, and nothing had sprung up, and Yahweh had not caused it to rain, and there was no man to till the ground. Boy, what's there? If you got none of those things, what do you discover in chapter 2 about...
In my Bible, he has thus the heavens and the earth were finished.
Well, you're in chapter 2, verse... 2, verse 4. 2, verse 4. See where I got the verses? 2, verse 4. We've got some sort of a new beginning there. It says, on the day... We'll pick up. That's at the end of the column over at the end. Good point. 2 verse 4 and 5, 4b and 5. So in the sheet that I've got hammered out there, right? Where that new beginning starts. When on the day that God made the heavens and the earth, or the earth and the heavens, when no plant of the field was yet, and no herb was there, and so forth, and God had not caused it to rain. Now, tell me what picture that is. There's no rain, and there's no grass. Desert? Okay, let's just put it here. Desert. Is there anything there? No man. Deep sky, there's no deep there. Or is there? Maybe there is. At this point, we can't see it deep. Those first verses tell you, above all, there is no rain. And there's no grass, and there's no trees. So we obviously have desert. And we know we have to have some sort of dirt, because that's what God uses later on to make man. We've got desert, and we've got dust. Now, that's very interesting. There was no man. And you have to turn over the page to the next column, the same column, but on the next page. Then it says, and then there's a word there. Some people translated it mist, but most people today translate it fountain. RSV says a kind of underground flood. I don't know what the word means, really. It only occurs twice in the whole Bible. So your guess is probably as good as mine as to what that word means. When you have a word only occurring twice, how do you know, how do you figure out what the word means? The Hebrew word occurs only twice. Once in Job and once here. How do I figure out what that word means?
Just temporary writing.
Oh, so you would go to other writings, like Babylonian writings. Okay? Contemporary writings that are not part of the Old Testament. If I go to those contemporary writings, I would translate it fountain. What other ways have I got? If I'm working within the Old Testament, how do I figure out what that word means?
Could it be river?
Could be river. Could be rivers, possibly a river. However, the Babylonian way, your guess is a pretty good guess at that point. I'd probably buy it. But one of the things that we know from the Babylonian word that you mentioned is that there's some kind of underground, it's called an Idu, I don't give you the name of it. I call it a fountain. A fountain from the underground water. The fountain from the underground water comes up. Now you said rivers. Why'd you say rivers? Okay, good girl. Right on. In verse 14, it says, verse 10 rather, and a river flowed out of Eden. Okay, let's allow that. That this is a fountain, and that the rivers come out of it. And where do they go? Four different directions, don't they? Now, if you have a river that comes out and goes into four different directions, what, where on earth is this particular desert? Because it's going to have to be a pretty high kind of place, isn't it? You're going to have to then not have the bottom of the flat desert, but somehow or another it's going to have to be like this. And out of it comes the water that goes four directions. So now we're starting to get a picture of this thing. We've got no rain, no trees, no grass, but something where water flows from it in four directions. Right? Okay, good.
I have a problem, and I'm wondering how do you decide this came later, if we're jumping down
to verse 10 already. All right, let's
do it. I'd like to know why verse 6 couldn't be happening at the same time as verse 5.
Does
it have to be a desert? This myth could be part of that same sentence.
Which sentence? The
first
sentence?
Same
sentence as verse 5.
Yeah, God
all right,
let's
do that.
But a mist went up. Earth.
Well, you just translated it, miss.
At the same time.
All right, so something came up. The majority of the evidence suggests that something comes out. But there is water there. All right, water comes up, but there's no rain. That's the difference.
Yes, but I'm wondering now, if this mist is there already, or the water, however it's going to be there,
yeah.
Long before this river
okay,
starts
that may
flowing
be.
Out of Eden.
All right, so there's something there, and later on the river is made. Okay, that could be. I'll grant that possibility. For the moment, let's just say we've got something coming out that's there. Call it mist or fountain, whichever you like. I call it fountain for a particular reason, because I think it's parallel to what happens in the flood story. When the flood story happens, the water's open and the water comes down, and what's the other half of the story?
I'm not worried about that word in general. I'm just worried that maybe it wasn't a desert, just mist. Might have been there.
All right.
As part of that same sentence.
There's some kind of moisture, but there's no trees, and there's no grass. So if there's no grass, it's not going to be. It's going to be dead.
It doesn't have to be dry desert.
Yeah. Well, it's going to have to be rocks or something, isn't it?
Well, the mist though would keep it.
All right. Or it's damp desert
then. Yeah.
All right. All right. So, but there's no grass, and there's no trees, there's no vegetation, there's no life. Absolutely no life. Just some kind of moisture, whether it's from under or from over, but no rain. And because there's no rain, there's no vegetation growing. So there's nothing on this. It's damp desert, or whatever you're going to call it. Now let's call it damp desert for the moment, okay?
Chapter 2, before we finish with chapter 2, I have verse 11 and chapter 1, because there it says, he said, let grass be, and all the other things. How do we get to this other point?
A good question, ma'am. That's a real good question. What happens, let's go to the next step. What happens in verse 7? Verse 6, you've got this situation. Verse 7, what happens? What happens in verse 7? God takes some of the dust here.
We'll take a piece of it.
And he makes a man.
A man is made, and there he sits on the desert. The damp desert and one man.
Well, that's what's there, isn't it? Now, I don't want to pull your leg on this. If that's not there, tell me. Genesis 2 has a desert and a something, some kind of moisture and a man. Correct? Or not correct? Is it not in the text or is it in the text?
But it doesn't say what day.
It says on the day that he made this, though he made a man. On that day. Doesn't it? On the day that God made the heaven and the earth, there was no plant, etc., etc., a fountain came up and God made a man. Now, after he made the man, well, now your question was a good one.
Yeah, I mean, I was back to chapter 1.
It did, eh?
We're getting down to the. How come did we go to chapter 2 before we finished 1? Because we haven't even gotten the days in here yet.
Well, it just says on the day. Now, in chapter 1, let's go to chapter 1 then. In chapter 1, when is it that God makes man? Huh? On the sixth day, after he's made the trees and the grass and the animals and everything else. In Genesis 2, what gets made first? Man. Man is created first. Of all the things that are made on that earth, man is created first. In the other story, my neck is getting stuck. In the other story, man is created last. Now, is it or is it not what's in the text? Man is created either first or last. Now, is that saying something? If you're very precise about it and look at the next step, after God creates man, what does he create second in this story?
The garden.
The garden, the vegetation. See? So the vegetation comes after the creation of man. And then third comes what? The rivers and the animals. Then come the animals. And all of this is man comes first. In the other story, man comes last. Now, does that say anything to you? Right?
In verse 1 of chapter 2, it says, thus the heavens and the earth were finished and all the whole stuff. Wouldn't that mean everything in the heavens and the earth?
In chapter, to the end of chapter?
No, beginning of chapter 2.
Yeah, that's right. The story that I have listed as Genesis 1 is a story that starts with 1 verse 1 and goes to 2 verse 4. Then we've got a whole new beginning, which says, when God first made the heavens and the earth, there was nothing. There was no trees, there weren't. And he made a man. And then he made the vegetation, and then he made the animals, and last of all, he made the womb. Now my question is, why is there a problem saying in one story man was made first and then the other one is made last? Is there a problem for you when I say that? Why is there a problem?
Because you have the impression that God made man to take care of the Garden of Eden, and in this account he prepares the Garden of Eden for man. I have a problem. No contradiction.
All right, you see a contradiction. You see a contradiction.
Well, what she just said, then, my purpose for being here is to take care of what's here.
Of the world, and God's the world.
Yeah.
And you don't have any problem with that, right?
Yeah.
That is a problem. Ecology is a big problem, right. I agree with you. And right now, we aren't doing a very good job of taking care of God's good earth. Right. Okay.
In verse 5 of chapter 2, it tells us that the plant life and earth and sea were made first and then man.
What?
Verse 5, chapter 2.
Okay.
Because every plant of the field before it was in the earth, and every herb of the field before it grew, and there was not a man to till the ground.
No plant of the field was yet in the earth.
There was no plant in the earth yet.
The
question on verse 4, chapter 2, on the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heaven.
Okay.
And God made it, and then he made man. Now on the day that he made the earth and the heaven.
All right, so the heaven and earth are made, and then it says the earth, there was no grass.
Right.
And there was...
Yeah. And then he made that there is a heaven and an earth.
Oh yeah, all right. I'm just describing.
This is then different than in chapter 1.
Yes, he's describing the process of, he's not talking about how he made the heavens. He simply says, when God made the heaven and the earth, then this is the way things were. There was no grass, there was no trees, and there was no rain.
Right.
And then he starts off the whole of creation after the universe as such is made with, with man. But that's the things on the world begin with the creation of man. And the things on the world or in the world, in the other story, end with the creation of man. Now, why is it that somehow it seems to bother one of us or the other of us that you have that difference?
Well, if there's two different accounts and the facts are a little different, and if we say that God inspired these ancient people to write, then why did God give two different accounts? That's the problem I have.
Okay.
I don't have a problem with creation, but if you look at it this way, that God inspired these people to write, and God doing the writing and telling them what to say, then why do we have two different accounts? Did God change his mind, or did he just give us two different stories? Or is man just interpreting the way he thought at that time?
Great pile of good questions. All right, if you want to say something, Matt. Yeah. All right, anyone else? All right, yes.
It seems like one chapter gives a lie to the other.
Oh, never say that.
I know I shouldn't, but I mean, it seems to
contradict. Never say that, because, you see, I don't believe that God ever is going to lead you astray.
Yeah, God does say that there are going to be things that we're not going to understand. And we're not
going to
understand that.
Okay, I grant that. But my point is, if we can't understand it, let's try. I may end up not knowing.
We're trying to understand what God is going to get for us.
Oh, didn't he tell me that? He gave me a brain and he says, figure out what I'm doing.
There are some things that we're not quite understanding. Well,
that's true.
With me in heaven.
That's true. But if there is a simple answer to this question, why shouldn't I try and find it? Maybe God has given me the clues, but we are looking at it from the wrong...
But if we don't find the answer,
no.
No,
what does your faith depend on? Good. It depends on your belief in Jesus Christ, and if some things do appear to be in conflict, it's not going to change your faith. Your faith is dependent upon Him.
Well, I have a question here, though. Pardon the way my opinion, King James Version is laid out. In chapter 2, verse 4, as I have always been taught, there is a sort of division time, and in verse 8, there's a division of time, and so on through. But this has nothing to do with this, and the way that it was put together.
Could be. It's worth questioning. Worth searching out. All right, you are next, I think.
He said he gave us a mind. Yes, but don't forget that it's a finite mind. It is a limited mind of man. God did not give us a mind whereby we would know all things as he does.
We would
be on the same lane, and we would have no problem of seeking.
Yeah.
So we are not. We are going to have to, don't forget also, the business of accepting like the faith of a child. Many of these things are not going to be revealed to us.
Yeah, but my question would be, I grant that my faith must be the faith of a child, but must my reason? Must I not try and figure out what God is doing in these texts and what he's trying to communicate? Now, I grant my mind is as finite as anybody else's, but shouldn't I ask the questions that God is saying, find out, search the scriptures, find out what I am saying and doing. And then without a mind, I can't figure those things out. I can't search those things out. And as I do, as I search it, and I confront him, he grants me faith. But my faith is grounded in Christ and not necessarily bothered by this fact. But it lasts. The moment God puts two things that are different side by side somewhere, he must have a reason. And if he's got a reason, then he must be saying to me something by it. And I'm simply saying, what is God trying to tell me by putting these two things right there? Now we have 15 minutes and we got a bunch of hands here. I'd like to get to this.
Well, you know, Daniel 12, verse 9, the prophecy that Daniel had made, God had told him, but he said, go now, Daniel, for what I have said is not to be understood until the time of the end.
Well, what he had just said there, yes, in that particular book.
Well, but maybe...
You think he's talking about the rest of the Bible, too?
Yeah,
if I use that kind of philosophy, though, that I'm never going to understand these things to the end, I'm not going to bother to study. Yeah. No, the point is, God says, search the Scriptures, and you'll find me there. And Jesus Christ encourages his disciples, and call, look for me. And so that's what I'm trying to do. Find it. Here, what's God saying at this point? And if he puts two things differently and separately, there must be a reason. And I'd like to get to that reason if we could. Yeah. One more question, and we'll call the halt for the questions for a little bit.
Well, this whole thing brings me to the attention of our creed. And in the third article, we read the explanation to that particular segment, the third article, I believe in the Holy Ghost, the Holy Christian Church, the communion of saints, the union of sins, the resurrection of the body, and the life everlasting. Now, what does this mean? And Luther specifically states, I believe that I can, by my own reason or strength,
believe
in Jesus Christ, my Lord, or come to him, but the Holy Ghost has called me by the gospel, enlightened me with his gifts, and sanctified and kept me in the true faith.
All right, so it is indeed God that gives you the faith, and not you yourself, and no fact, in fact, that's going to lead you to faith. Only the Spirit. Right. All right, let's go to the text. I'll come back. And so we have some people who want to throw some more questions back at the end. We can. If I were to say, all right, let's take a look at this in the terms of the total, since the time is starting to surge ahead, and I were to say, how does this whole thing hang together, each one of these three? And I would ask you a question, and we'll go back to what we did before on the other side of the board. Does it help me to ask the question, what kind of thing is going on? What kind of writing is this? If I look at Psalm 104, what kind of writing is Psalm 104 if you listen to it? Starts off, bless the Lord, O my soul, you are very great. What does that suggest to you? Or if you go to the end of the whole thing, go to the very last page. May the glory of God endure forever, and may Yahweh rejoice whatever he creates. I will sing to the Lord as long as I live, and so on. What is that psalm framed by, the beginning and the end? What kind of literature is that?
A song.
It's a song. It's a poem. It's a hymn. It's above all a hymn. And so you have to recognize it's a song, a psalm, a hymn. And it's a song, and when you sing your hymn in church, brightest and best of the sons of the morning. Right? You sing that, and it's beautiful. Who are the sons of the morning?
God.
The sons of light. If you really look at Job, they seem to be heavenly beings, the angels. Is that the way you sang it? But it's a poetic expression, isn't it? Sons of the morning. Now, if you take Psalm 104 and reckon with the fact that in hymns you have those kinds of things, your purpose, what is the function of a hymn? To praise God. It's certainly, now if we go to the function of a hymn, is not to be a news release. Is it? And so if I try to make Psalm 104 a news release, I am really wrecking Psalm 104. And I'm not going to be getting it's not going to have the value, and it's not going to have the point. And if Psalm 104 bothers to describe light, God as light, rather than accenting the creating of life, or if Psalm 104 says in verse 19, God creates darkness, that's a very interesting statement. In the other one, he's there. If Psalm 104 talks about God playing with Leviathan, the great sea dragon, am I going to get hung up about God having his frolic in the sea with a big whale or something? I can go right through that thing. But I recognize that I am not going to treat it the same way as I would treat an Israelite or an editorial or anything else. It is a cry of praise, and there I rapture poetic, and I am describing the truths about God in the midst of it. But don't make me make it something other than a sign. It's true, but it's true through a different vehicle. Call it in. Okay?
Just could it be that chapter 1 is a chronology? It gives it in days, in 7 days, 6 days of creation, and one of rest. And in chapter 2, he's not worried about time. This has taken place, and somebody is describing what has happened. Not necessarily in the order that it happened, but he is saying what has happened.
Okay.
One is a, if you will, a news report, and another one is an editorial of what's happened.
So you're back to those two terms. Let's look at it a little closer. That's a good try. And if you want to use that expression, you may. But let me look at a couple of other things in the text. Look at the way Genesis 2 ends. The last line. What's the conclusion of Genesis 2? What's the word you start off with? Therefore. All right, what happens when you have a therefore in a sentence?
Somewhere before.
Somewhere before? Well, point one. You don't start off. Therefore, dear friends, that's right. Therefore, what does the therefore indicate to you in addition to saying there was something that preceded it? It is the point to which you're moving. Therefore, this is the case. You have preceded talking about certain things that are leading up to that particular point. And what's the point he is making, ultimately, in the finale in verse 24? Therefore, man and woman shall leave their parents and cleave to each other. The point of that story is to teach you something true about man and woman. Well, what kind of document is it then? If its purpose is to teach you something about the nature of man and woman.
It's the history of man, then
they're
not worrying about the
others. Right. One, it relates to man, and its purpose is concerned with man, not about, as you said, chronology. It's concerned about teaching you what man is about. Or, if what word did I use just then? Teaches. It's some form, primarily, it would be then, that's one way of describing it, of instruction. Because its point is to teach you something about man and woman. Now, if I call it instruction, or catechism, if you like, told in a story form, that means that the point of the story, the point of the instruction is what I'm after, and that will govern certain things. I want to teach you about man and woman. And if I want to teach you about man and woman, the way to understand the character and the nature of man and woman is to realize certain things. One, man is made out of dust. That's the most important thing about the character of man, that God created him out of dust. To emphasize that, you stop. Second thing that's true about man is that he is put on this earth to take care of God's good work. The third thing that's important about man is that he cannot relate to the animals adequately in order to be a full and complete being. The fourth thing is that man is the one who really gives the name and the being and the character to all the animals. He names them. By naming them, he really is the one who has authority over them and distinguishes one from the other. It is man the thinker. Man, the one who distinguishes between things. He gives all things their name. But still, man the thinker and man the gardener is not fully man. Is he? With all those things, man is still not truly human. He is only truly human when God does the last thing, the most important thing, the thing that is the climax of creation, namely, creates a woman. And then, man and woman become one, and truly what they're intended to be. And if they then leave their parents, there's no reference to parents even. There were no previous parents with it. But the point of the story is to teach you something about your relationship as a human being to your parents. And there wasn't any parents yet. In other words, the creation story is related to the question of who man is in relationship to his parents and to man to his wife.
What
God
was created in God's image.
Oh, that's a very good point. That's another part of Genesis 1. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But did you get the thing that I was saying? To understand that story, you had better look at the fact that there's a therefore at the end of it, which is not the way you do a news report. This happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. The point of this story is, therefore, to be a man, true human being, this is the way you relate to the other person, and how you relate to your forebears, and how you relate to God. That's what it means to be man. And that's a divine message. Call it instruction, call it what you like. And the way you taught instruction in the ancient world was to use a full story form. But we are hung up on chronology. They're not. They've got a more important thing than chronology to talk about. And so chronology, in order to say man had a certain relationship to the universe, you start. And you want to talk about man, that's the focal point, so you start. It's really as simple as that. Point two, the question you raised. 5 minutes. If you go to Genesis 1, the story ends with man. And it ends with man in a remarkable way. It says, God made man in his image. Male and female he created them. Mankind is in his image. Now there's some people who insist that only man is in the image of God and not woman. That's not what's in the Genesis text, by the way. If anybody wants to pull that on you. Now, when it says God creates man in his image, it explains that in a few verses of the next verse. If you go back to it, you'll see it. Let us make man in our image after our likeness. And then it says, and let him have dominion. Now, if you carefully go back and ask the question, what did the word image mean in that day and age? You'll discover that the word image is the term for the representation of God or the representation of a king in some kind of physical form, stone, pillar, or whatever. And frequently what a king will do will take a stone pillar and put it on his boundary. And that's the symbol of my presence. And you don't knock that down and you don't invade that territory. It's the representative of me right there. To be an image of somebody is to represent somebody. So here, man is to represent God and do what God does on the highest level, namely rule. Man is supposed to be the one who rules or has dominion in the world. If you will, he is the balance wheel of creation. He is the one who's supposed to keep order. And the moment that man rebels and departs from his center, of course, there is disorder in the world. There is upheaval. There is imbalance. Which is, of course, what's been happening around us. Now, that's the picture that's here. And that's not inconsistent with Genesis 2. It's simply another way of portraying man. And it portrays man in terms of the generality. Mankind is made. It doesn't say anything about creating one man in one moment. It says, God created, let us create them. And he creates mankind in Genesis 1, in his image. With no allusion to the first pair at all. Simply, mankind is the word. Is a very interesting so that a whole lot of things different because he's trying to do something different and say something different. And I've only given you a few of the clues of what's different between the two stories. Now, if you go back to that first story, just a couple of little sidelights to bring it to the fore. One little real interesting sidelight. I like little things as well. If you look at verses 20 to 23, after God made all the fish and the birds and everything else in chapter 1, what else does he make? Sea monsters. Now, why on earth refer to the sea monster, the great dragon? That seems to be so, and it's not a category, a major category of life for everybody. Is it? The birds are one thing, the animals are another thing, the fish are another thing. Why mention the sea dragon? Well, because if you lived in that world, for many, many people, this, the name Deep, was the name of a sea dragon. And what has he done with the sea dragons? He's relegated them to the fifth day as an appendix to the fish. So they, there is no longer any great dragon that he must confront at the beginning. This is no longer a dragon, it is simply water. And many of the parallel stories of that day and age, the god fought the dragon to create the world. In this text, he'll have nothing to do with that. But he has to get the dragons in to make people see where they fit. This wasn't the dragons. They are simply marginal afterthoughts. So he really degrades them. And they no longer are the forebading, frightening things. And what happens to the dragon in Psalm 104? Leviathan is another name for the dragon, the sea dragon, and God plays with him in the water. His big heavenly beach ball. That truly defrocks the dragon again. So you have a number of these places where the dragon is really defused. Because the Israelites are living in a world where the dragon, the chaos, was really a dragon to be feared. And there may be references to it in the Old Testament. I'm not going to deny the possibility, but this writer is clearly against identifying chaos with the dragon. That's not the way it is. And the beginning was not begun by God with a great fight, but simply by God saying, by the word of God, distinguishing things one from the other. And my last point is to go right to the end of Genesis 1. Say, we said, how did Genesis Psalm 104 end? How does Psalm Genesis 2 end? How does Genesis 1 end? Genesis 1 ends with a very interesting note. All of it leads up, and it's really not as much concerned about the 6 days as ultimately the most important day of all is which day? The seventh day. In short, the function of Genesis 1 is really related to its conclusion also. Thus, he says, it was all finished and God rested. And on that day, he set aside one day in which he rested, the day when Israel remembers God the Creator. That is the Sabbath day. Eventually, it's identified as the Sabbath day. And the point of this story of creation here is to relate creation to the worship of the seventh day. So that every time you worship on the seventh day, you are doing what God did the first time he ever made everything. He worshiped. He rested. He rejoiced. Psalm 104 says exactly the same thing. God rejoices, he celebrates whenever he creates. And you likewise celebrate on the seventh day. You celebrate the creating of God, and God celebrates his creating whenever he creates. That's Psalm 104. Interesting thing. On Sunday, you're not celebrating alone. The Lord is celebrating with you. And so is all creation, says Psalm 148. And all of Genesis 7:1 is really saying, the important thing is not simply to focus upon what happened on which day. That's all part of the picture. But important, or most important, it leads you to the seventh day, which is the worship day. And I would say the context in which this story is really alive for Israel was in their worship. Not as an Israel report. But, if you will, something like a creed in this service. Now look at one other little thing. Look, I put down the structure of it. Take a look at the structure of Psalm 104. I mean, of Genesis 1, the last page. Notice the first day. Each of the first day corresponds to the fourth, the second to the fifth, the third to the sixth. The first day is light, the fourth day is those things in the light bodies, the things that carry the light, sun, moon, stars. Notice the light is created before the sun, that's it, because the second day, the firmament, which separates the waters from the waters. And the fifth day, the things that are in the firmament and the water, namely the birds and the fish. The third day is the dry land and the vegetation. The sixth day are the things that live on the dry land, and the use of the vegetation. It's a very careful structure. This has been honed down in terms of patterns that are very precise. It's not just like a news report. It's a carefully organized literary piece, like a creed, you see, with a conclusion that relates to the very day when you're worshiping. It is a beautiful piece of literature. Now, that doesn't say anything about it not happening or not being true. It simply says something about the form of it that will say, tell you where it fits. It doesn't fit in the newspaper. It fits in worship. And the second one doesn't fit in the newspaper. It fits in instruction. And the middle one doesn't fit in the newspaper as we know it. It fits in your singing a hymn of praise. That's the form of it in the back. Where does it fit? One question.
By teaching Genesis 1 and 2 to our seminary students, do you teach them or tell them that Adam and Eve were true characters?
True characters?
Living persons.
Well, I would move into Genesis, Genesis 3, 2 and 3. The portrait that I would say here is that is whether or not that question is the primary question, or whether instruction is the primary question. And at this point, I would say that maybe that's a question that we are bothered by, which maybe the Israelite wasn't. Is that the kind of question he's asking in that text? And I really think that's another whole lecture, and I really ought to start from scratch and lead up to it with that kind of question in mind. And to be honest with you, see, the word Adam means it means mankind. And as such, it's interpretable. You can interpret it either as man or as Adam. Both ways are possible. And from that point of view, you'd have to ask the question, which is the most likely, and why would I opt for one or the other? Now, there are a lot of people who would opt for one or the other, so I'm not going to come down on one side of the fence or the other without giving you the evidence for why I would come down on one side of the fence or the other. I think that's only fair to me as I try to do the same thing with today's text. Now, why do I say these things are important in terms of where they fit?
I think it's very important because I think that is one of the problems that has concerned the laity in this area.
Okay, then let's have another lecture. We'll talk about Genesis 3. That's only fair, I think, if we're going to talk about it. If that's the real problem, then we should have been talking about Genesis 3 instead of Genesis 1. And to me, I was trying to get at that same kind of question by saying, what kind of literature do we have in Genesis 1 and 2? And I really think we probably ought to call it a halt to it, because a lot of people have to go, and we had said we would stop at 10, and I'm already giving you way over. I really appreciate this, and I hope that we've done something to help you see what we're trying to get at. If I haven't answered all the questions, I don't know all the answers, and I want to make it clear that the kind of questions that are still hanging are still, I would operate with the same, hopefully, the same kind of honesty, the same kind of recognition that I begin out of faith with my Lord, and that I'm merely trying out of that same faith to say, what on earth is God trying to say here? With some of these awarenesses that God uses what people are and what people have, the way they communicate in their day and age, without ever trying to deny what God is saying to me. And that's what I must hear. Thanks very much.